That's what you do. You want to chase that feeling, you know, when you're at the end of the bed playing your guitar and you're just, strumming along and playing a song, and then you're hoping that people like it. And then they do, it's nice. And that's why we came back. I mean, I'm 46 now, and when we started, I was, what, 27 years old when it all hit, you know. But, it's a different time. We've always been good friends, haven't we? So we stuck together, and that's the main reason we got back together, because we just thought we missed hanging out and wanted to play music together, and that's important, don't you think? Guys, back me up here. Yeah, so that's what we did. We decided to play in a band and get back together and get on the road and see if people liked us anymore. And have fun, you know, because life should be fun. You should be enjoying yourself, so you should not, depressed all the time.
So, I guess the question I'd like to ask is, if humans weren't on the planet, would the planet survive? Well, we know the answer. The world survived very well without us for many, many millions of years. We don't survive off-planet. Well, not naturally, anyway. Artificially, yes, but the planet and all its creatures and all its life survives without our input. It needs nothing of us. No interference, no pollution, no commerce, nothing. It is perfect. It is a perfect planet that will come to an end as it did a beginning. And we are just particles, atoms, stardust that have come together for a time to roam this earth, as did the dinosaurs and many other living creatures that have come into being and are now extinct. To hasten that would be a dereliction of duty. To hasten the demise of our own planet, as well as ourselves, would just be madness. So I say to you again, what is more important, the planet or the human? It's all in our own minds. Ergo, ego. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti.
"In the plain meaning of the word, sir," said I. "I was on my way to your house when I was trepanned on board the brig, cruelly struck down, thrown below, and knew no more of anything till we were far at sea. I was destined for the plantations, a fate that in God's providence I have escaped. The brig was lost on June the 27th, says he, looking in his book, "and we are now at August the 24th. Here is a considerable hiatus, Mr. Balfour, of near upon 2 months.
I'm taking a walk in Bushy Park, with my dog Rocco, and we're trying our best to ignore all the deer and the runners and the cyclists and all that, and trying not to think about drink and heroin. It's, because I was on a skag for 3 years. I had drinking all my life, but I didn't drink no more. It's hard to do because I haven't got the wains with me. And it's a bit cloudy at state, it's bloody cloudy. Winter's coming, and it's not sunny no more, but it's warm. It's warm down here in the south. Where am I? Oh, well, I'm not in Aberdeen or Forfar, I can tell you that. I'm in Kilcoddy. I'm in Bushy Park. Very posh Bushy Park, where I have deer and stag and skylarks and magpies and crows and squirrels and you name it, any rodent thing they got here. And me and Rocco are just walking, Rocco's a tiny little thing, a tiny little cur, little mutt. And he's been shiting all night, on the mat at home. And not good shites either, big piles of steaming dirt, chocolate milk. It's not good, because you can't clean that up without a smell, it stinks. Anyways, I could be on heroin, so things are better than what they were. You know, I could be on the skag, you know. Well, in a few years' time, later, I'll be over it completely.
In the cupboard were a few bottles, some apparently of medicine, a great many bills and other papers, which I should willingly enough have rummaged, had I had the time, and a few necessaries that were nothing to my purpose. Thence I turned to the chests. The first was full of meal, the second of money bags, and papers tied into sheaves, in the third with many other things, and these for the most part clothes. I found a rusty, ugly-looking Highland dirk without the scabbard. This then I concealed inside my waistcoat, and turned to my uncle. He lay as he had fallen, all huddled, with one knee up and one arm, sprawling abroad. His face had a strange colour of blue, and he seemed to have ceased breathing. Fear came on me that he was dead. Then I got water, and dashed it in his face, and with that he seemed to come a little to himself, working his mouth and fluttering his eyelids. At last he looked up and he saw me, and there came into his eyes a terror that was not of this world. "Come, come," said I, "sit up. Are ye alive?" he sobbed. "Oh, man, are ye alive?" "That's am I," said I. "Small thanks to you." He had begun to seek for his breath with deep sighs. "The blue thial," said he, "in the armoury. The blue vial." His breath came slower still. I ran to the cupboard, and sure enough found a blue vial of medicine, with those dose written on it on paper, and this I administered to him with what speed I might.
The only man unaffected by the Dooley family's marvels of cycling technique was Grigory Danilovich Rimsky. He sat alone in his office, biting his thin lips, his face twitching spasmodically. First, Likodeyev had vanished in the most bizarre circumstances. Now, Varenuker had suddenly disappeared. Rimsky knew where Varenuker had been going to, but the man had simply gone and had never come back. He shrugged his shoulders and muttered to himself, "But why?" Nothing would have been simpler for a sensible, practical man like Rimsky to have telephoned the place where Varenuker had gone and to have found out what had happened to him. Yet it was 10 o'clock in that evening before he could bring himself to do so. Aye.